Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Overthrows podcast. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter. And back with me after a long vacation and hanging out with giraffes and whatnot is Jared Kimber, who you can find literally everywhere. How was it, Jared, the time off?
That was great. It was good fun. Giraffes.
Yeah. Well, good to have you back. We've also got Sag in the comments who wants Estelle on the podcast. Soon enough, Sag, don't worry. Sri Lanka are also playing. We'll have her on.
She's working on a piece at the moment. So when she finishes the piece, she can come back on the podcast.
Yeah. Amit M is here, SS98 and Arco, of course. And I'm not surprised that Arco is over here because today, first on the menu, this entire Overthrows podcast is dedicated to Bangladesh creating history in Rawalpindi. Let me set this up for you, Jared. Prior to this tour, Bangladesh had played 65 away tests and won 6 out of them. And they had only won 2 away test series, out of which one was against Zimbabwe and one was the Floyd Reefer series. Remember when they toured the West Indies?
Of course I remember the Floyd Reefer series. Yeah. Everyone, and by that, just in case you're not like a sick person like me and Behram, what he means is he means the series where the West Indies players went on strike and they just picked random guys, including the great Floyd Reefer.
But that's not the only thing. Bangladesh, in 13 attempts, had never defeated Pakistan prior to this tour in a test match. And let's not forget that these players and the entire nation is in the midst of political unrest. They've gone through a bit of a revolution. They've also, you know, faced some floods, loss of life, livelihoods, all of that. And you can't forget that the BCB is in complete disarray because the government has been overthrown. And keeping all of that context in mind, Bangladesh have just, you know, gone on to defeat first Pakistan for the very first time in a test match in 14 attempts. And then they went on to sweep Pakistan in their own backyard. And the second test, practically, you know, they defeated Pakistan in 3 days. How huge!
It's massive. And I think to add to that, of course, is the historical element, right? Which is that Bangladesh was Pakistan. It was East Pakistan. Yeah. And, you know, I remember I did an article a few years ago because all these Bangladesh fans would contact me saying, why does Ramiz Raja hate us? And I was like, why does anyone care what Ramiz Raja thinks? Like not at that stage, he wasn't like a PCB person. He was just a commentator who occasionally did tournaments. And I'd never taken him all that seriously. But then when you start to unpack the historical tensions and everything else, and you look at the, you know, the situation where Bangladesh used to have a player called Niaz Ahmed who would occasionally play for Pakistan, despite the fact that he was essentially just there so that they could say that they had a player from East Pakistan in their side. It's, you know, you do start to unpack on all of this and you realize that it means a lot more to Bangladesh fans that they beat Pakistan than any other team, right? That is the main team, and it makes sense that it is the main team. So this is probably their greatest ever victory, right? I know they've had individual victories over some very good teams. The New Zealand win was incredible. They've done some great things in World Cups at times. But to beat Pakistan twice at home, I think it's the biggest thing they've ever done. And as you said, the cricket board's in disarray. I don't know how many times Pakistan have ever lost to a team with a worse cricket board before. The country's in disarray. Shakib Al Hasan was in an FIR about a murder, right? We all know he probably had nothing to do with that at all. But everything was going on. The floods kept coming and all these sorts of things were happening. I can't think of a better time for Bangladesh to beat Pakistan than right here and right now. An incredible effort from them.
Yeah, the timing really was perfect if you think about it. And the nation is going through a bit of a, you know, rebirth. And the cricket team might just as well, you know, and this is a very well-deserved victory. Mm. Bangladesh outplayed Pakistan across all three departments. I was there, right? Every single day at the ground. So I know that they batted well, they fielded well, they bowled well. Or better than Pakistan. And then what you said is very, very important because there is a historic connotation over here. And if there is one team that will make this occasion all the more special for Bangladesh is when they defeat Pakistan in Pakistan, right? Because of all of that. And even though both countries kind of get along well now and there's no, I mean, you know how India and Pakistan have all of this baggage? That doesn't really, or at least I don't see it exist with Bangladesh, but it still is big. And I just felt that, you know, the fact that Mushfiq, who had scored 191, an important one in the first test. And Shakib Al Hasan, who you correctly pointed out, is currently, you know, allegedly an accomplice to murder, even though he was in Canada at the time. Those two guys being at the crease when Bangladesh sealed victory just makes this all the more iconic. And I love that about this particular win.
Yeah, and I think maybe iconic is the best term, because I don't know if... What's Bangladesh's second most iconic moment?
Well, there is Cardiff 2005, a bunch of like clean sweeps at home in ODI series. They won a test each versus England and Australia. A good few World Cup runs, right? 2015, 2019, throw in 2007 for knocking out India, because that was big for them. And maybe the Champions Trophy in which they made the semi. But like you said, I don't think any of those things stack up.
I don't think I just don't think those are iconic. Like, they're important and they were wins. And, you know, the New Zealand win, as we said before as well, you throw that one in there as well. None of them are iconic. And there's something about this. And maybe the narrative plays a part here, and where the country is and everything else. And who the victims are, you know, who the losing team is, and where the tests are being played. But it's just like everything has fallen together. I just feel like in 20 or 30 years' time, this series is going to be mentioned. And I don't think, with all due respect, Mohammad Ashraful beating Australia in Cardiff is going to... Do you know what I mean? Like, I find it hard to believe that that one is going to stay in the same way that this one is. And you know, even the Champions Trophy, I'd forgotten about the Champions Trophy semi-final, right? So I think when you look at it, it just feels to me like I hope, looking back, it's a little bit like what we saw with, you know, New Zealand drawing with England in 1949, right? One of those moments where something actually happened that we can all trace back to, it began there. Right. And, you know, the four leg spinners of South Africa and all those sorts of different stories that we know. This just feels like this is that for them. And even if it's not, and it gets forgotten or anything else, maybe it's the relief that the country needs at the moment. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, and you look at, I've been writing a documentary at the moment for Australian TV, and, you know, looking at sort of Don Bradman. And it's very hard for modern people to understand why Don Bradman means so much to Australia. And you have to understand that Don Bradman comes along when the depression is there. So at the same time, you've got the struggling nation trying to come through. They've got this great depression. No one can work. I think it was something like 33% unemployment or something crazy like that. But Don Bradman was smashing the poms, right? And there's an element of the right George Best in it, you know, is another, you know, the right person at the right time, you know, all these sorts of different people, they come along and they represent something more just because of the state of the world at that time, right? And, you know, Maradona versus England and all those sorts of things. And we don't know how long this one will stick around, but it's the first time I've thought to myself, this should stick around. Like, if you go back through all their other accomplishments, this is the one I think really should matter for a long period of time.
Oh, 100% agree. There's also that one Asia Cup in which they lost the final to Pakistan at home. That was the only other sign of, let's say, continuity that Bangladesh are, you know, improving. Or even the ODI clean sweeps at home. But over here, you know, this is not a one-off. They beat New Zealand at Mount Maunganui, but then they lost the other test match. Over here, they defeated Pakistan twice in Rawalpindi.
In two tests as well.
And two tests, and quite comprehensively, in the sense that Pakistan, I felt, you know, are a team that are trying to reinvent the wheel, and Bangladesh just played test cricket like it has been played for like a good 130 years or whatever.
Are you saying that Bangladesh weren't using AI technology?
Not at all. Also, Jared, fix the volume. We're getting a couple of comments about that, so maybe you should like increase that a bit. So fantastic achievement for Bangladesh. Both of us are in agreement that it is their biggest moment ever in the history of their cricket. And, you know, their performers in this test match in particular, Bangladesh were reduced to 26 for 6. You know, they crumbled versus the new ball, versus Khurram Shahzad and Mir Hamza. And then the pair of Mehdi Hasan Miraz and Litton Das added 165 runs. And Bangladesh ultimately multiplied their score by 10 from 26 for 6. They ended up with 262. Never in the history of Test cricket has a team lost 6 wickets under 30 runs. And the 7th wicket has gone on to put up more than 150 runs. Litton was injured in this innings, Jared, midway. He scored 138. And then Mehdi Hasan Miraz was spectacular throughout the series, right? 78 with the bat in that partnership. And 5 for 61 in the first innings of the game. 10 wickets in the series at less than 19 apiece and 155 runs at 77.5. He completely owned Pakistan in this particular series. And then he dedicated his award to the student protesters as well. So Litton and Mehdi, really, you know, that's the story, at least in this particular test match. But there's more. I'll let you comment on this first.
Look, I think the batting's quite interesting when you look at the entire series, because essentially they're in a situation where they only batted three times, but two incredible innings is what's won them this series as far as batting goes. And that's the issue about whether this is repeatable in the future, right? You're not going to get two innings like this that are going to win you two tests in the way that they have. And I'm taking Mehdi out of this for a moment because I'll talk about him separately. But they really were two outlier performances. Hmm. And for Bangladesh to be good consistently, that's the difference, right? You know, bowlers win you matches and batters make you consistent, right? Those are the two things that those jobs do, right? So that's great that they've got those innings, but now we want to see if they can do it over and again. But both of those innings, I mean, Litton has scored less than a Mushfiqur, but that innings was just absolutely extraordinary, right? And the as you said, the injury as well and how that played a part, basically playing with at that point where you think you're out of the game and everything else. I just thought it was majestic. And I think we gave him the most improved player award, or he was certainly nominated for it last year. This is the Litton Das that I think a lot of us have been expecting for a long time. So it was absolutely fantastic to see that happen. He's got so much talent, but it doesn't always come through. But yeah, so from the batting point of view, I think that's really important. Mehdi Hasan, I think the reason I am more bullish after this, and I don't think they're about to go and beat India or anything, right? Or you know, I was going to say beat Australia in Australia, but it might never play there. But what I do think is they've, with Mehdi Hasan at the level he's currently at, and Shakib hopefully wanting to play on for a couple more years, they have built a bowling lineup that can spin the ball in both directions and can bat at number 6, 7, 8. And so they've got extra batting in their side and extra bowling in their side because of these two guys, without losing anything from the bowling, right? And that's without really losing anything from the batting. Like Mehdi Hasan, if you bat him at number 8 and you bat Shakib at number 6, if that's the way that you want to do it, you're not losing anything at all in those situations. So then you look at what we've seen recently. You know, we've seen guys who bowled beautifully with the new ball in the World Cup, didn't even make it into this squad. We've seen their leg spinner just get picked up by the Big Bash. We are seeing, you know, the kinds of bowl, we've never seen this many seam bowlers of this level of talent out of Bangladesh ever. Like,
never.
So there's a lot of good things to suddenly look at this. And it's like, I'm sure there will be a moment where we slag off Pakistan later on. And I don't understand why the last 3 years Pakistan have decided they never want to take a wicket anymore. I'm not sure the AI would suggest that, Bayram. But if you look at Bangladesh from an analyst point of view, the way I am, and the way it's now coming together, you're like, they've suddenly got a bowling attack that should work in multiple places. And they should have extra batting down the order because of the all-round opportunities that they have there. Yep. That's a hell of a place to be, right?
Absolutely. Like, it's a luxury to have Mehdi Hasan Miraz at number 8. And he was that guy who built two very, very important partnerships for Bangladesh in both test matches, right? In the first one, he put on 196 runs with Mushfiqur Rahim, which is a record 7th wicket partnership for Bangladesh. And in the second one, he put up 165 runs with Litton, who, by the way, has 4 test hundreds, and 2 of them have now come versus Pakistan. No other Bangladesh batter has 2 test hundreds versus Pakistan. So records were tumbling left, right and center. And I felt that Bangladesh really applied themselves well. At the crease. And, you know, at times they were just not very expansive. They were compact, playing within themselves. And at times they attacked the crap out of Pakistan, especially Litton and Mehdi. You know, Shan Masood spread out his field and it was a touch defensive and they were still hitting sixes over fine leg. So that was really a sight to witness. But for me, the batting is not the most promising thing from Bangladesh. Not even Mehdi, as spectacular as he's been. Did you get a chance to watch Nahid Rana bowl?
Yes.
In this test, 1 for 58 in the first innings does not do justice to his bowling. And 4 for 44 in the second innings, First three overs, gets three wickets. And who are those three wickets? Pakistan's captain, Shaan Masood, Pakistan's premier batter, Babar Azam, and Pakistan's most informed batter, Saud Shakil. Gets those three, ends with 4 for 44. He was ripping through Pakistan. And you know what? I saw him in the first test. Jared, he was erratic. Mm. And in this particular test, he kept that, or kept hitting that fourth stump line. Basically, Bangladesh got all of these Pakistan batters out fishing outside of off stump, right? That's how they got them out. And he was very, very disciplined and mighty quick. He was rapid, spitting venom, fire in his belly, everything you want to see in a fast bowler, 150 plus clicks in Rawalpindi, of all places, which is the home to the fastest bowler in history. And that came from the opposition team. All of Bangladesh's seamers, their average speeds were higher than Pakistan's seamers. I feel like that's a story.
If you are following my work, we know that you are a true cricket sadist and you need your hit every day. And sometimes, sadly, there is actually no cricket to watch. So how about if someone made a very fun game that you could use for the moments when there is no on-field action? Welcome to Hit Wicket, a strategic game of cricket, which isn't about slamming your finger on the screen very fast. You work out what works best based on how cricket actually works. Dot balls lead to wickets, ones and twos to fours and sixes. So there is no way you can bowl a great Yorker every ball or smash three sixes at the beginning of your innings. This is proper cricket. Yet it still has some gaming powers in there as well. Hit Wicket is about playing, but also building and managing your team. You are the batter, bowler, owner, coach, and captain. It's your dream. No ads, just cricket. So download Hit Wicket today, because this is a cricket game made for you and supported by major cricket nerds. I think that's incredible. And I think that goes back to what we were saying before of there's something actually building there. And we know there's other guys not in this side or not in this squad that can also add to everything we've just seen. Look, I think he's raw and he's a prospect. He reminds me a little bit of Shemar Joseph in that there are, it's either he's going to be in rhythm and it's going to work exactly as it's supposed to, or he's not going to be in rhythm and we're all going to be like, what? Why do we like this guy? So I do think there's going to be an element of that happening at times. But he's, you look at the squad they're putting together of seam bowlers and the variety of which they have in seam bowlers, and they can pick different things for different situations and go in any direction that they want to go in. And I just don't think we've seen something like that before for them. And I think in the past, we've seen a young Bangladesh bowler come in and look good. And then they've sort of gone out of the side for a little while because of fitness or because of form or whatever that may be. And then and it just never comes about. Whereas now you kind of feel, well, they're trying some younger players and this is quite good, but they've got some more experienced players that they can bring back in. And they've got, left arm bowlers and right arm bowlers, and they've got taller bowlers and got faster bowlers, and they've got skittier bowlers. They can really put together something quite special. And so that all that hype and all that hope doesn't have to be on one guy to be, the great anymore. And that was the thing I noticed about their bowling attack was he only took six wickets in the series. Am I right?
Yeah, he didn't take many wickets, but he had that impact. Anyone who watched him bowl.
But what I mean is he didn't. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like most of their bowlers chipped in. Right.
Yeah. Even in this game, Hassan Mahmood, he took 5 for 43. He had better numbers than Nahid Rana. But anyone who watched the game would know exactly what Nahid Rana did.
But even when he chipped in Mahmood at the end to end that innings, that's what made that chase easy, right? So the impact, you're right. But my point is that they don't need a guy to come in and take 7 or 8 for, right? Hmm. They don't need. Back in the old days when Shakib had to take all the wickets and make all the runs, right? There are just parts of this. And it looked to me like watching most of the second test, little bit of the first test, it looked to me that there was one team who everyone knew their individual role and what they were in the side for.
Yep.
And then there was another team who probably had maybe marginally more talent on the pitch, but no one really knew what their role was or how they fit into the side at any one point. And it really looked as simple as that. One team looked organized and the other one didn't.
Yeah, I think Bangladesh's execution of plans was far better than Pakistan. Pakistan at times, I felt, had put all of their eggs in one basket and they were like, this is plan A. But they never had a contingency plan. And as for the seamers, like, they've got the fizz in limited overs, right? We've seen the new guy, Tanzeem, was it? Tanzeem Hassan Saqib in the T20 World Cup.
T20 World Cup, yeah.
And like you said, these guys weren't even part of the team. They've got Tuskin back from injury. He took 3 for 57 in the first innings. Shaurya Full had a groin niggle. He didn't even get to play this test match, yeah. Right? The left arm seamer. And then Hasan Mahmood comes in and gets his first fifer in his test career, which is very, very short right now. He's just played like 3 or 4 tests. And as you said, when he took Rizwan and Muhammad Ali off successive deliveries, Pakistan were almost done and dusted at that point. So Bangladesh have a really exciting team kind of coming through the ranks now. And this is a massive win. Could be a watershed moment, might not be a watershed moment, but it's something that this nation can rejoice, relish, celebrate like no tomorrow, because I feel like they've earned it. And at this particular time, you know, in their history, where, of course, like the government has been toppled, but there's a lot more work to do. It's not like their problems have been fixed. And I was like, I spent a lot of time with Mohammed Assam from ESPN Crick Info, practically living together for like 17 days.
I feel sorry for you. Assam's one of the worst people I've ever met. Disgusting man.
But he was telling me how him and, you know, the team manager, who I also got close to, and a lot of these players are actually quite afraid leaving their families behind in such conditions, right? So you have to think about all of these things and then the performance that these boys have put, and it's just beyond phenomenal. I think like it, that song needs to be sung over and over again. But now it's time for us to come to Pakistan. Let me list down some things.
Do I need to be here? Do you want me to just go to the pub now?
No, no. I've spoken a lot on Pakistan already. I have a 2.5-hour podcast with Saad. It's a movie. It's not a podcast. It's a movie. So people have heard me enough. I want your thoughts on a lot of things. Pakistan, 10 winless tests at home. That is the second worst streak in their history. The worst was 11, which was 1969-75 when their team was shit. They last won a test match at home versus South Africa in early 2021, so 3+ years. And in 12 home series since March 2022 across formats, Pakistan have won 3. This year, Pakistan have only won a solitary series in Ireland in which they lost one game as well. It's all really nosedived, hasn't it?
It's not good. I mean, so I did a piece, I suppose it would be 3 years ago now, right? Where I was basically saying that Pakistan had the best World Test Championship schedule.
Yeah, I remember that.
To go into the finals. Almost from the moment I wrote that, nothing has gone right. It's gone completely downhill. In the last 3 years, they've got 5 wins in 10 matches. But I think it's more, for me, it's more about just their inability to like take any wickets. Like they've just stopped taking wickets in Test cricket. So I've got these numbers up here. Let me find them. So India's bowling average is 24.5 in the last 3 years in Test cricket. South Africa is just above them, and Australia, they're both around about 26. Then you've got England, New Zealand, Sri Lanka, all around 31. West Indies and Bangladesh around 33, right? So obviously the teams in the 20s, you're doing great. That's awesome. Your life's really good right now, right? If you're around 30, 31, you're probably in a position to win test matches. And if you have a look at England, New Zealand, Sri Lanka, I think that all makes a lot of sense. Pakistan's bowling average at the moment is 36.77. So the only teams that are worse than them are Ireland and Afghanistan. And even Zimbabwe has a lower bowling average. And if you compare them to one of the other major test playing nations, West Indies, who have won 5 games and lost 12 games, they're taking their wickets at 33.87. Right. So we know their problem is batting, not bowling, even if their bowling isn't quite good enough to overcome their batting. But with Pakistan, it's like, if you're taking a wicket every 36.77 runs, like, my God, think about what you would think if that was a bowler. If that was like one bowler, you'd be sitting there going, how's he still in the team? Right. And when it's an entire side doing that, and in that 3-year period, not a single Pakistani bowler has 40 wickets. Right?
That's crazy.
So Abra Ahmed has 39 and 7, by the way. So he should he's unlucky not to get his 40.
He had 38 and 6, by the way. He took one wicket, and that too after 39 overs in this test match. Yep. So he was toothless. But, I mean, he's barely played. They haven't even let him play first-class cricket because he's always on the bench or a reserve player, and he's never gotten any game time. So I wouldn't entirely blame him. No. Remember that stat that Shayan or Varun showed us in the group in which, you know, Pakistan, how they struggle to clean up the tail? They had Bangladesh for at 26-6 and they conceded 262. That's a multiplier of 10. That should not be happening in any world. And I remember in the chart, I can't remember the exact numbers, but Pakistan had the worst bowling average versus batters 6-11 across all test playing nations, I believe, in a 3 or 5 year period.
Yeah.
I can't quite recall. It's somewhere in the chat.
And it was, so and again, it was, the picture. It wasn't close again. Like they were by far away, like a really, really poor side. And, you know, it's they're not taking wickets. So I think they're still reasonably okay with a new ball. But first change bowling, older ball bowling and spin bowling outside of Abrar. And Abrar's been fine. He hasn't been sensational.
Yeah.
Some of those numbers is more to do with the fact that, what would you put it? Some of those numbers are more to do with the fact that some of those guys got caught on bad Pakistani flat wickets. But the issue with that is that the other team still took wickets, right? So it's all well and good to say that Pakistan have bowled on some flat wickets and that those numbers are worse, and that we can agree with that. But when it comes down to it, and if you go through also, like, there's a systemic issue here, right? So Shaheen has regressed. Yasir Shah regressed. Shadab Khan regressed, right?
Yep.
There's a lot of guys who are... We're talking about two guys who were on the path, well, maybe even three, who are on the path to Pakistani greatness, and two guys maybe even on the path to beyond that in Shaheen and Yasir at certain points in their career. I don't know what happened to Yasir Shah at all, but that's done. Shadab Khan.
I think his back was done.
Yeah.
Yasir put in a lot of effort from his back, so I think that was the issue with him.
Shadab Khan's groin is done, and obviously Shaheen's knee. So they've had some bad luck with those three players, and you take three bowlers of that quality out of your side, and you're going to struggle. But I don't think we can look at flat pitches and the fact that they've had regression from those three guys as the reason for this. There's a deeper thing going on here, right?
Definitely. And, you know, at 26-6, let's not take away anything away from Khurram Shahzad. He took 4 in that spell and absolutely, you know, rattled Bangladesh's left-arm batters. Ended with 6-90. Mir Hamza was unlucky to end with 2-15 that innings because a lot of chances were dropped off his bowling. And Pakistan actually... So both teams made a lot of mistakes in this test. Bangladesh dropped 5 catches across 2 innings and Pakistan had 8 errors, which includes dropped catches, non-appeals, non-reviews, the ball falling short right in front of the fielder. So they made more mistakes, clearly. But I feel like at 26-6, if Pakistan perhaps had someone like a Naseem Shah in the team who was really good with the old ball, even if Bangladesh recovered, they would have recovered to, what, 150, 170 tops. And Naseem was rested from this test. And Shah, and I asked Shah this question in the presser. Why would you rest Naseem Shah, right? I get the Shaheen bit. He has regressed. He just had a kid. And, you know, he was very, very poor in the first test. I think he had 27.5 overs wicketless. It took him till the third new ball to strike. So I can understand if he was even dropped, even if they claim it's rested, right? What they kind of fucked up over there was that he came back after the birth of his child and then they said bye-bye. They should have just told him prior. So Pakistan's communication or the PCB's communication has always been off. But Naseem has built a reputation of being a great old ball bowler and he can actually clean up tails. So, I mean, you had Muhammad Ali who lost his fitness. In the first innings, he bowled 7 overs. And then in the second innings, Khurram Shahzad's fitness fell apart. So Shaan Masood, who by the way is at 5 losses out of 5 as test captain, the worst ever for a Pakistan captain, he offered an apology and lamented player fitness due to lack of test cricket. And he said that we're building a stock of bowlers. That's why we didn't play Naseem. You build stocks when you're 1-0 up, not 1-0 down. And you can't not rest Naseem in that sort of situation. Those are just my 2 cents.
This is brought to you by Cricket 8. They are a new player in the game trying to educate fans on what is really happening in cricket. We have a partnership with them where we host live watch-alongs, do podcasts and write articles. If you want to know what is really happening with our game, visit cricket8.com. I mean, it'd be interesting to me to know if that's actually what happened, whether he was actually rested or whether he just had a niggle and they didn't want to go with that.
I asked Gillespie. He said he's completely fine. And I saw Naseem bowling between sessions every day.
Yeah. I like the idea of resting seam bowlers. And I think it's a good situation to be from. Which Pakistani bowlers have been overbowled, though. Like I just said, no one's taken 40 wickets, right? And so let of the seam bowlers, let's have a look here. I'm trying to have a look. So Shaheen Afridi has bowled 377 overs in the last 3 years. Noman Ali has bowled 385.
He's a spinner, so.
I just want to go to the top because I realized I skipped him. Abra Ahmed has 369, and then Nasim has 281. Now, obviously, they played limited overs, and this is not just that. But this isn't a situation where Pakistan play a lot of test matches. Now, perhaps there is a... And remember, Jason Gillespie was also a prodigal son as a bowler and was injured almost all of his early life. And you've got him coming in as coach. There is a possibility he's come in and said, look, this guy looks like he's running in the red to me. Let's just...
Yeah, and also, sorry I'm interrupting you, but Pakistan bowled 167.3 overs in one of the innings in the first test.
Yeah.
Nasim bowled like 30 overs, right? And Shahan in the presser said in hindsight, he would have played... You know, Nasim and Shaheen in a test each spread out.
Yeah,
but he didn't do that.
Yeah, right. And look, the first test, they probably thought they were going to get a win. And it's probably ended up being a situation where maybe they had a plan beforehand. But the overall point is that, like, you know, all these different factors come together. It doesn't... I never care about this, right? Mm. And the reason I don't care about who was rested and who wasn't rested is because... They haven't been taking any fucking wickets for ages.
Yeah.
Right?
That's true.
Like, Shaheen Afridi is averaging 30.66 in his last 11 test matches after being maybe the best strike bowler in the world. Right? I'm not saying he's bad now, but he's not what he used to be. Nazim Shah, we both think is... We don't even know what the ceiling is for Nazim Shah yet, right?
True.
His last 9 test matches, he's averaged 28. Again, you look at the bowlers around the world in what is a pretty decent era to be bowling, and you think to yourself... These guys are just not taking the wickets. And if that's your best two bowlers, and then you've got to give, you know, Noman Ali, you know, who's taking his wickets at 40 in that period, right? Mm. You know, who's the guy who's bowled the most and is no longer part of the plans, is that fair to say? Or certainly not?
Yeah, I mean, he's fairly old now. Yeah. I don't think he'll be part of plans.
Right? So it's not like they keep, who are they keeping out? Hassan Ali, right? He was taking his wickets at 40 or 50 when he was playing.
Yeah.
That's the issue for me. It isn't that they might have made a mistake with selection all the way through this, because it is a new system, right? And we've had 83 different selectors. No one even knows who the selector is on a day-by-day basis, from what I can tell. Team managers, you know, everything is going on at the PCB is in fast motion. They've got a new coach there.
Yeah.
I kind of expect teams to make some mistakes with selection, right? And I think what probably happened is they thought, we'll get by in that first test and then we'll try some youngsters perhaps in the second test and see how we go. Mm. They also didn't expect Bangladesh to play as well as they did. Like, and that's absolutely on them. But that, you know, that is based on the 65 matches that Bangladesh had won 6. And I think the one stat that you forgot is my favorite one, that of the 65 matches that Bangladesh had played away from home, they'd lost 32 by an innings, right?
Wow.
So... You can understand them being slightly thinking to themselves, hey, they're a good team and they'll give some challenges at times, but we'll be able to overcome them. But my bigger issue is that you just it doesn't matter if I look at a spinner or a quick bowler, like I just go through this list and I'm like, there's no one here that really is forcing me as an international batter at the moment to worry about. Right, Nazim Shah is the closest, absolutely. And even so, compared to some of the other bowlers around the world, I just don't think he's quite at that level right now, even if he has the potential to be. And certainly Shaheen Afridi isn't at that level at the moment.
Definitely. But there's also a psychological element to this, right? Bangladesh now know that Shaheen and Nasim are not playing, right? And now they'll probably feel more comfortable of winning the series in which they have an unassailable lead. Yeah. So I feel like not playing Nasim had... It's layered. There are multiple layers to that. And even without Nasim, I feel like Shaheen could have been more proactive to kind of manufacture a wicket and not concede 262 after having the opposition at 26-6. Like, I saw the field spread out. I asked him and he said that you kind of have to look at the runs. You don't want to concede too many. And the deep point fielder is a catching position. I wasn't sold on those answers because when this field was spread out, Litton and Mehdi were still hitting sixes. It's not like they cared. So might as well add some pressure as well.
Yeah.
It's not Baz ball. You're not being Pat Cummins and pragmatic and all of that. And I certainly feel, Jared, a lot of people have asked me this question. This is far worse than losing to the USA in a one-off T20 in Dallas. You know, any team can win a T20 on their day, but being defeated at home in a test series versus a lower-ranked side to whom you have never lost in your history is pretty bad. Like every time we feel like Pakistan has hit rock bottom, there's a new slump and we're like, this might be rock bottom. But it just continues and it's quite chaotic. Like Jared, Rawalpindi is a ground which fills up the stadium, the crowd at least, on inconsequential days of test cricket. You know it's going to be a draw. They'll still pack the stadium. No one turned up. There were like 100 people tops every single day. And like 25 of those were from Bangladesh, right? This is harrowing. This is never, like, we've never seen this before. Rawalpindi had built a reputation for always filling up the crowd. And here we are.
Yeah, it's the issue here is that if there was some kind of stable management or an overriding plan, I think you and I would say, look, sometimes you're going to go through periods where you lose, right? As I said before, the overall talent on that field, I'm not sure that Pakistan didn't still have Bangladesh slightly beaten. As a team, I think Bangladesh played better. But Pakistan also had chances to win both of those tests and should have won both of those tests if with the talent that they had available to them. And let's say they did. Let's say they won one, right? I don't think they'd be in a better situation now if they'd won one of those tests than if they hadn't. And the truth is that it isn't about individual results. It isn't about losing to the USA. Did they lose to Zimbabwe at one stage?
Lost a test match in 2013. Mizbah's team actually lost a test match in Zimbabwe.
Yeah, so, you know, and that wasn't exactly...
Pakistan have also lost at home versus Zimbabwe, actually, in 96 or 97, when they had all their stars.
That was a good Zimbabwe side. So they lost to Zimbabwe back in those days. They've lost to Ireland recently. They've lost to the USA. There's clearly an overarching problem here. And it still comes back to me to the very basics of what are you doing as a cricket culture to put everything in the order that you need it to be in? So I've just done a podcast with Roberta Moretti Avery from Brazil Cricket. And they've got a theory in Brazil cricket, which is, I think it's think large, but start small. Right. And Ireland did a similar thing when they came in. They were like, we're not going to play test cricket tomorrow. Right. But if we keep putting things in the right situation. And so what they do in Brazil cricket is they actually get people, they put people through university to train them up as coaches. Right. And they're now doing that with physios and they're doing that with admin and you know, all these different things. They're putting people through the system who are cricket people, but training them up correctly and bringing them back and also using them while they're at university for other things. Right. I'm not comparing Brazil and Pakistan from cricket culture, but what I'm saying is, what are the small things that the PCB are doing that is correct? Everything I've seen from the chairman has been big swings and attention grabbing and everything else. Don't get me wrong, they need some big swings at the moment, but you have to put everything in the correct order. Like, you know, to make it about cricket again for a moment, Brendan McCullum can only be Brendan McCullum because he has worked out a method of how to attack and he knows that when he has to defend a ball, he still can, right? And the PCB are trying to be all of the Brendan McCullum attacking shots without any of the processes that went into Brendan McCullum becoming Brendan McCullum. And then on top of that, without the defense when he needs the defense, right? And look, I get it. He's an ambitious politician who's come in and it was a shit show before him. So we're not blaming him for what it was. But there needs to be an adult in the room. And I remember when I did my podcast with Wazim Khan, I know what that was, 2 or 3 years ago. And like, you see the comments from Pakistani people, and there were so many like partisan political comments and he's an outsider and everything else. And you're like, do you know what? And I'm not like Wazim Khan's biggest fan. I don't think he's done great work with the ICC or anything. I don't think he's done terrible work. I don't think he did great work with the PCB. Do you know what Wazim Khan is? He's an adult.
Yeah.
And he makes decisions. Yeah, a professional. He makes decisions based on the information that he has at that time. Now, that may be warped and he may make bad decisions and everything else. It just doesn't feel like Pakistan cricket is being run by an adult again. And when you have a situation like that, this is where these things end up.
Yeah, he is definitely a man-child. I would go on to say that even. And of course, it's a political appointment. It's very authoritarian, you know, in Pakistan in general right now, not just the PCB. And in Mohsin Naqvi's tenure, Pakistan have won that series versus Ireland. They even drew versus New Zealand's Z team. And I'm not exaggerating, right? Everyone was not playing for New Zealand.
That was a bad team.
Exactly. So they've got nothing to show for thus far. Now, you know, the team has also lost or been swept by Bangladesh in their series at home. And just to come to the batting a bit, right, I want to talk about Pakistan's batting. And we'll discuss Babar later because I know that Babar needs to be discussed. Look at, you know, the scores in the first innings in this test. Shaan, looking good, gets to 57, playing brisk, throws it away. Saim Ayub, looking good once again, shows a lot of promise, gets to 58, is out-stumped in a very ugly fashion. Salman Ali Agha, he had a good test, 54 runs in the first innings, 47 in the second, but he was lucky at times, so was Rizwan, who scored a fighting 43 but was dropped on a duck. Abdullah Shafiq, the opener, is averaging about 12 in the last 10 innings, and every time he's getting out, you know, driving the ball or playing away from his body. Saud Shakil, generally someone who's done really well for Pakistan in test cricket, scored 141 in the first test and had three failures. I think there were three single-digit scores that followed. So the top four of Pakistan really shat the bed.
Yep.
And it's always kind of up to Rizwan, Salman, and sometimes Saud to rescue the ship. We'll discuss Babar in a bit because he's also not working. But I feel like rather than getting brisk 50s, maybe Pakistan need to focus more on daddy hundreds because that's what Bangladesh did. Litton and Mehdi put up that partnership, whereas Pakistan didn't have that. None of those guys cashed in.
Yeah, I think Pakistan had had some success trying their own version of baseball, hadn't they? If I'm not mistaken.
And versus Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
Versus Sri Lanka and Sri Lanka.
It's not a consistent method. I think England have proven that, if nothing else, right? And you also need the right players to be able to do it and everything else.
Yeah.
I don't think the Pakistani players have been mad with it or anything, but I think they've tried to show more intent. And, you know, having followed Jason Gillespie for a long time, I would assume he's the sort of one to be like, no, back yourself. If you think this is the right method, you know, you back yourself. I wouldn't throw the batters under the bed because if you look at, and again, we have to factor in the flat pitches at home, but if you look at their batters overall in the last two or three years, that hasn't been the issue. It really is a bowling issue. It's really quite
That's clear that
the bowling is where the problems have been coming in. But in this particular series, I think you can have a look at that and that method and everything else. I thought they were an interesting team to try it because the sort of baseball method, because they're so good at rotating the strike in T20 and white ball cricket. And that's really what baseball is. It isn't really hitting sixes and fours. It's literally, you know, taking solid gambles to move the field and then milking the field. So I thought Pakistan was a decent option to do that, but also think that like, they've got about three or four players who are just really good anyway. And I'm not sure that they desperately need to do that. But it is interesting. You look at, you know, Imam Al-Haq, and I know his numbers are lopsided because he makes all of his runs at one ground.
Yeah.
But, you know, they made some big swings with their batting before this series. And I don't think, for me, the batting has been the issue at all. I really do think it has been the bowling, and the batting has been... If you put in Sri Lanka's bowling lineup, right, into this team, I think the Pakistan team would be pretty good at the moment, right? Like, maybe even the Bangladesh bowling lineup, right? Like, I mean, certainly the West Indies bowling lineup, any of those sort of, and we're not talking about elite bowling lineups, we're talking about good, solid test bowling lineups. I think Pakistan would be a pretty good team. But, you know, if you lose to Bangladesh and you're running down and getting stumped and you are trying something new, I think everyone's going to obsess over that. And the Babar Azam thing, and I think, you know, you've probably covered it on the, you know, podcast here before, and I'm sure you've had to talk about it for hours as well. There's an issue there. What that issue is at the moment, I don't know. But there's clearly an issue there. He's not the player that he once was. Who knows if that's going to come back or how hard that's going to come back. And, you know, it might be one of those things where one day he picks up the bat differently or gets a heavier bat or a thicker grip and he just goes, oh, no, this makes sense now. Sometimes it's nothing at all and he doesn't even know what he's fixed.
Yeah, so I remember you mentioning to me that you had a theory that Babar might be a cluster batter, right? Yeah. Had a really poor start to his test career and then he had this massive purple patch in which he was unaffected by the pace playing pandemic as well, was playing the wobble ball fine. And now the slump is just maybe even slightly worse. It is slightly worse than that initial bad patch. And, you know, 16 innings in test cricket without a 50 is sizable. That's 8 games, right? 8 test matches. And I was, before the series, confused whether it's a mental thing or a technical thing. But you look at him bat at least when he wasn't scoring runs in at the start of this rough patch, he still looked good out there when he was batting for however many he scored. You look at it now, look at him now, and he's really, really struggling. Like, the feet are going nowhere. His balance is off. He's falling on deliveries, playing away from his body and going out in ugly fashion. And also, like, in the last 2 years, he's been caught down the leg side by the keeper like 6 times. You remember how he was kind of found out at short mid wicket in between? Mm. He has developed patterns of similar dismissals. And I feel like, and I was convinced by Daniel Rasool of Cricinfo about this, that, you know, every great batter goes through this struggle period where they don't score any runs and they have to reinvent themselves. Daniel thinks that Babar was an extremely talented batter who did really well on his talent. And now when it's come to the reinvention stage, maybe he doesn't have the wits to figure this one out. And that is why I don't know if the cluster batter thing is true or if this is an actual regression and he may never be that same batter again. And I suppose that's where we're at in this conversation.
This is brought to you by HitWicket, the cricket game that has playing and strategy all in your pocket. So I've been, yeah, so the cluster batter thing, I've never done a piece on it, although, you know, I might have to now because of what he's been doing. But so 2010 and 2011, 2013, those are just 3 professional years. Doesn't play in 2011. But 10, 12, and 13 he plays in. He averages mid-20s. He then over the space of his next 8 games in 2014, 2015, averages over 60 in that period. He then averages about 28 over 2016 and 2017. Then he has 3 big years averaging over 50, another year down at 34, another year up at 69, and now 2 years. That feels to me like a cluster batter, which the best way of putting that is it's a little bit like a rhythm bowler. So I don't know if he completely knows what he's doing right when it's going right, and I don't know if he completely knows what he's doing wrong when it's going wrong. So think Mohammad Siraj, Stuart Broad, Shemar Joseph, who, you know, plenty of bowlers that we've seen this. And the guy I compared him to was Usman Khawaja. They're not dumb guys. Like, you know, Stuart Broad and Usman Khawaja and, you know, Mohammad Siraj, there's a lot going on with those sorts of people. But their physicality, they don't know how to control it in the way that Jimmy Anderson or Sachin Tendulkar or Alistair Cook is just like, oh, wait, my elbow's gone here. Well, I'll just stop doing that. Right? And that will change everything. Yeah. And, you know, they don't do that. And so to me, that does not look like a pattern of a guy who understands what he does correctly. Clearly, he has a great eye. Clearly, he has a great natural technique. And he's got the temperament of a top club level batter. So he's got 3 things that, like, I'd say he's got 3 things in those skills that Faf du Plessis would have absolutely, you know, that, you know, better than Faf du Plessis had. Faf du Plessis didn't have a great technique, right? And Faf du Plessis had a really good eye. I'm not sure it's anywhere near on the level of this eye. He did have the temperament though, but Faf du Plessis knew exactly what he was trying to do in every innings, right? You watch him in T20 cricket. When he changed his T20 game, he knew exactly what he was doing. And so Faf du Plessis is never going to go down as a great batter, but I would argue he got everything out of himself all the way through. You look at Babar Azam and you do start to think to yourself, does he know himself well enough? Does he know how to get the most out of himself? And, you know, I've spoken to so, I mean, not just making this book, but over my career, I've just spoken to so many batters. And sometimes I'll say to you, yeah, I knew there was something wrong. And then I just kept tweaking until I got it right. Like, I couldn't work out what it was, but I did this. Or I didn't realize there's something wrong. People kept telling me there's something wrong. I told them they were wrong. Then I looked at footage one day and I was like, oh, I see what they're saying. And I fixed it. I just don't think Babar Azam's one of those 2 guys. I just think he almost has to click back into it naturally. And it's one of those things of, we think all great, and he's going to go down as a Pakistani great probably, unless this is it. And then, you know, unless he just keeps batting like this for the next 5 years and then no. But do you know what I mean? He's probably going to have a few more years where he makes a lot more runs. And if he's Pakistani, he'll probably play till he's 83, right? So, you know, he'll be averaging 38 when he's 83 and we'll be like, oh, what a legend. So I think he's just going to be one of those guys who just maybe finds it hard to understand what it is that is working for him and isn't working for him. And it's, not everyone is a great self-analyst and not everyone can be fixed by a coach. And those sorts of, I mean, it's the, to go back to the Stuart Broad analogy before, like, Could you imagine if Stuart Broad played the way he did on those magical days more consistently? Mm. Whereas Glenn McGrath, on you throw the ball to Glenn McGrath, the chances are he's going to bowl a test match quality delivery that is going to be hard to keep out on any single day. If he could have had shorts and flip-flops on, could have had a pina colada in one hand and be licking an ice cream in the other, and you take him out, take them out of his hand, throw a ball to him. He's going to come in, he's going to hit a line, it's going to be a probing ball, it's going to be there. With Stuart Broad, his first one's probably going to be really stiff and loose, and it's not going to go exactly where he wants, and he's going to be working his way back, and then he's going to be trying to get his rhythm up, and he's like, oh, I can't work out why I can't do this. Stuart Broad had the best analysts, the best coaches, the best video system, the best everything around him, and couldn't work out how to get his legs pumping the way he wanted to when he bowled at his best, right?
That's interesting.
Maybe Babar Azam is that. And when I'm talking about cluster batters, I've seen this pattern a lot, especially looking
Khwaja. At... Khwaja.
Yeah, but that's Khwaja of recent times. But looking at the great batters of all time, you see this pattern a lot, right? And it's, I know, I think we don't think about it in the same way we do about bowling, but I think it's a very similar thing where this guy just doesn't know how to do the thing that he needs to do. There's one other thing I would say about Babar Azam, which I think is really, really interesting. He's played 91 first-class matches, right? He's never played more than 10 first-class matches in a year.
That's true.
That's not a lot of cricket, right? Now, I don't think... He obviously plays limited overs cricket and he plays white ball cricket and, you know, all these sorts of domestic cricket and all this sort of other thing. I think he's probably most at home in one day cricket and test match cricket. And and I think, you know, just suits his overall game.
Yeah.
He doesn't actually play that many white ball games, one day games either. So, you know, he hasn't always been playing tons and tons of white ball games over the last couple of years. I think I'm right in saying that. Wasn't there like a 3-year period where he didn't play all that much in one day cricket?
Well, Pakistan didn't play.
Yeah,
much,
that's
right?
What I mean. I'm not saying
who plays ODIs anymore.
Yeah. So I think, I'm trying to bring it up here. Yeah, he played 18 ODIs from 2020 to 2022. Part of that was COVID as well. He hasn't played an ODI this year at all. Right?
Yep.
He's a rhythm, if he's a rhythm batter the way I think he is, what does he need more than anything else? Hours upon hours at the crease.
Yeah.
If that's not, if he's not getting that and he's not playing enough of this longer form of cricket, and we know, we watch him in T20 cricket, you and I have watched him as much as anyone. It's like, this man needs about 40 balls to wake up, right? Like, he's not built like a modern player.
Yeah,
I just wonder if, you know, you look at his overall record and he just hasn't faced enough balls to feel comfortable in a way to fix this problem of, how old is he? 27, 28, 29?
No, he's 29, turning 30 soon.
Right. So he's a 29-year-old who is already a Pakistani great, right? Like, I certainly things have been falling apart. But if you look at the history of Pakistani batters, averaging 44.51, like, is great. But you look at the amount of cricket he's played, and it doesn't look to me like he's played the appropriate level of cricket of a 30-year-old player who is of his level, right?
True.
And that might not matter for someone else. It probably doesn't matter for someone like Rizwan, right? I wonder if it matters for Babar Azam a little bit more. And, you know, I'm working this theory out kind of on the fly, but I did look at him for the book because when we started the book, he had a really good record. So when I started writing the book, it was like, oh, we're going to have to put Manas and Babar Azam in here. And like about a week into writing the book, we're like, well, those two are fucked. Things have gone on now. But I do think, I remember looking at his record and just being like, there's something here that doesn't quite gel. And I wonder if that is a part of it. It just feels really interesting to me. The amount of cricket that he has played, you know, maybe compared to some other players. And as I said, not everyone needs that, right? You know, Manas Labuschagne, I'm just going to bring his numbers up. So he's 30. He's just turned 30. He's played 152 first class games. So that's 60 more than Babar, right?
50% more. More than 50% more
and
than Babar.
Think about this. He was a late bloomer. Right?
Yeah.
He didn't make a lot of runs at the start of his career and, you know, really struggled to get into the Queensland side and you know, played for Australia, but kind of because they thought maybe he could bowl a little bit, right? Yep. And he's played a lot more first-class games than Bob Razum. And he's not really a white ball player. And he's also added another 150 white ball games, right? So
yeah.
There's an element here of, and I'm not comparing them, because it could have been that I think Marnus is the sort of guy that you put him in the nets long enough, he's going to overcome any issue that you give him. And he's just going to keep tinkering and changing until he makes it work. And he's in a bit of he's in his own slump at the moment, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Whereas I think with Bubba, I'm not sure that that works for him. I really think he just needs balls out in the middle and then for something to click and then him for almost subconsciously not even know what that thing is and just forget about it and just go on and make runs. But, you know, that's my theory. I just don't think we talk about batting the same way we do talk about bowling, whereas the more I've talked to batters, the more they're like, no, it's very similar. But, I mean, we're talking about a guy here with an ODI average of 57 or something, right? Like, I mean, crazy that he can't make a run anymore.
Yeah, it is quite bizarre. And I like this rhythm batter theory, because if Babar Azam is getting bowled off an inside edge whilst attempting a cover drive, then maybe, you know, there's some merit to that. But what I've been told from multiple sources is that he's a rigid person, not very open to change. So remember when you said he might, you know, coaching might not help him? Maybe, you know, he just needs to reinvent himself over here and make some tweak and maybe change his grip or something. We'll see. Time will tell whether Babar Azam is finished or if he will come back, because everyone is out with a pitchfork in Pakistan and they want his head, as if they have replacements lined up. That guy can replace Babar Azam, right?
That's a problem when someone like Babar Azam loses form. Like, it's, you know, even Australia at the moment with, you know, Smith and Marnus and Warner, like, losing form. It's like, so many of my friends are like, got to get rid of Warner. And I was like, well, so who's going to come in now and is going to average 37? Right? Like, and do that with a strike rate and make opposition teams nervous. Like, if you're saying Warner's terrible, that's fine. When your great players or your top level players lose form, it's the worst possible thing that can happen to you, because there aren't replacement level players for Babar Azam, right? Like, you know, I always say about this, you look at the IPL and it's like, if the difference between, like, if you have an international player who loses form, it's like, great, we've got another international player. Hopefully they'll be in form. If you have like a great Indian player lose form, it's like, okay, now we're going to have to pick either a 35-year-old who never did that well in the first place or a 20-year-old and hope that he's ready. And that's where this you're sort of at. And the annoying thing with this is that it's just going to either fix – it's probably just going to fix itself, right? Hmm. Like, as you said before, he might go off and just fix it himself and work it out or whatever that may be. Or as I said, it might just be he just – he's in an innings and suddenly everything starts coming back. And he's like, oh, great. So, you know, that Steve Smith thing of, oh, my hands are back, right? Like, you know, and then you don't know. Talking about my cricket this year. So this year was probably the first year I played probably as a specialist batter in my life, right? And I don't think I've seen the ball much better than I have in any other year than I did this year. And I don't think my footwork was much better than it's ever been this year. And I strolled to a not out 50 in the first game, and I'm not sure I made more than 20 in a game for the rest of the year, right? But I know I was seeing the ball like a balloon in some of those innings. Hmm. You know, have you ever heard the Greg Chappell story? When Greg Chappell made...
No, I haven't.
I can't remember exactly the scores, but I think he made four or five ducks and a couple of single figure scores over about 8 or 9 games in ODIs and test matches combined. And he's asked by someone, you know, what's the problem? And he goes, I'm seeing the ball great. I just keep getting out. Like, there's so, we just don't focus. And Greg Chappell's like a great batter. And he is sitting there in the middle of his career. He would have been about 30, 31 and going, I don't know. I don't know why I'm not making runs. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we can only wait and see how this will unfold. And Pakistan do have England in a month's time in Test cricket. We don't know if that series will be in Pakistan or the UAE currently, which does not make for great reading. And it would be, you know, a tragedy really for Pakistan's fans and the local media like myself, and also all the tour companies and the Barmy Army who would have booked flights, hotels, all of that sort of stuff. So hopefully, you know, we won't be jumping on an uncovered last minute to discuss how Pakistan will not be hosting the England series. One last thing I really want to talk to you about, though, and this is important. The conditions in the second test match in Pindi were phenomenal. Tony Hemming and the curators did an awesome job, and it was raining all day on day one. I live here. It's torrential rainfall. I had no hope of play starting on time on day two. It did. So the ground staff was great. And sure, Bangladesh wrapped things up in practically 3 days because we only had half of day four and they wrapped it up in half of day five. But what we saw was, even though the result didn't go Pakistan's way, it wasn't a draw for sure, which seemed like it would be the case, right, prior to the series and even the test match. And then it, like, the test cricket was riveting and very, very palatable. And the surface had a bit of everything, or it had something to offer to all kinds of cricketers.
Yeah.
Spinners took 6 wickets in the first innings for Bangladesh. There were times where the new ball was doing heaps, and then Nahid Rana and Hasan Mahmood really got that old ball to talk and ripped through Pakistan. And there were phases where batting was good as well. It was a good time to bat out there. I think that Tony Hemming and his team really nailed the conditions. And at least that is one positive for Pakistan, because prior to this, it was just like, oh my God, am I going to have to view a test match over here? Like, will there be any wickets?
Well, one of the reasons I thought Bangladesh would struggle to win, I think we had a hint that there would be more of a result focus. But the original thought was that Pakistan would struggle, Bangladesh would struggle to win just because winning in Pakistan is so hard, yeah. Right? Like, look, some of those wickets were terrible, and good on PCB for fighting the good fight when they put out terrible wickets and still went to the ICC to say, no, these are not terrible wickets. I don't think you can put out flat batting wickets anymore in red ball cricket. I think audiences have moved on from that, and they expect that bowlers can take wickets at any time. I think, I think in the old days, if you had like a 3.5 day test, people would be like, ooh. Whereas now, like 3.5 day test, everyone's like, great, that was exciting. Lots of things went on. It's different if it's 2 days or 1.5 days and it gets a bit dramatic. And I think Pakistan had to move forward. And well done to them. Say everything you want to say about Pakistan here. They produced result wickets. And it's the first time since they've started hosting again that you could really say that. Is that fair to say?
I mean, South Africa, 2021.
South Africa wasn't too bad, That was the one I was thinking about, which is, I suppose, is the only other one. But there haven't been many times when you've thought to yourself, I really want to watch this test match in Pakistan, right? Like, I'm a neutral. You have to demand my time and my energy. And I see Pakistan come up and I'm like, oh, it's 9 a.m. So we're in this session. What's the score? No, I'm out. This series wasn't like that. I was like, give it to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like the test cricket on offer in the second test was, you know, what fans want to watch, and that's what you pay your money for. And even contests between bat and ball, where there are different phases in which different kinds of cricketers are up on top. So I feel like that was at least one minor victory that Pakistan accomplished in this test series. But that pretty much wraps up our review. Let's go towards our Super Chats, Jared, before we wrap this up. All right, who do we have up first? We've got Thinesh Selvaratnam says, no questions, really enjoying all the content. Thank you, Thinesh.
That's a big super chat too, man. And we need massive, like a bell or a horn when someone comes in with the big chunk of change. So thank you very much, mate.
I'm gonna make a t-shirt with your name, Thinesh. Kaushal Talapadi says, will Mushir Khan, brother of Sarfaraz, be the next Jadeja?
So I miss this. I saw in our group people were talking about it today. Did he do something crazy today?
I saw his wagon wheel and he'd scored runs all over the park.
Oh, that was him that we were looking at, was it?
Yeah, so, I don't think I watched this. Like, I mean, I know I didn't watch this innings, but I have seen people rave about it on Twitter all day. So, yeah, there's that.
So he's 19 and he bowls. He's played 6 first-class games. That was his second 100. He's only made 150. I think his brother does that too, doesn't he? I think his brother's got like a ridiculous conversion rate as well. Averaging 58 in first-class cricket at the moment. And he's taken 7 wickets in 6 games. Bowling might not be there. But the wagon wheel looked great. I think we probably, both of us, have seen more of the wagon wheel than we have. I didn't even realize that was the wagon. I just saw a wagon wheel that was like really majestic and thought to myself, that's a pretty looking wagon wheel.
Let me just confirm if that was Mushir's wagon wheel, because maybe we have misstated over here and that would make us look really stupid.
Someone else's wagon wheel. There's many wagon
wheels. It is Mushir. It is Mushir Khan. So it was all across the park. And look, it's a talented family. The father works really hard on his sons, and I believe they are products of the Azad Maidans in Mumbai, I'm not wrong. So I mean, that's already a lot going in their favor. Sarfaraz has finally made it to India's test team. And Mushir was a part of the under-19 team and was doing really well. So, I mean, sky's the limit, I suppose. So
Just before we go, they're very different kinds of athletes, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because
yeah, I mean, I don't know what Mushir's physique is like, but...
No, I'm pretty sure that's the thing I remembered about them, because someone a while back, someone in Indian cricket sent me footage of him, like when he was younger. And I got confused because I thought it was Sarfraz. And I was like, I thought it was, they'd sent me, because they'd written a confusing WhatsApp. And I thought in it, they had literally said that this is Sarfraz. But what they had said is, this is Sarfraz's brother. And I just misunderstood it. They don't, you know, they're obviously both very talented. It'd be interesting to see if they have slightly different kinds of games. Because Sarfraz is, I think he's one of the most natural players of spin I've ever seen. It'd be interesting to see if his brother is better against pace or than he is, or, you know, has a different kind of technique against pace. But anyway, that's boring. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'll also have to see a bit more of Mushir to actually have an opinion on him. But thank you to everyone who came in the comments and sent us super chats. Just a quick reminder, you guys can go to www.goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage. It can prove to be a one-stop shop for all the work that we do as part of this team, whether it be written content, podcasts, or videos. We'll be back with more live videos, you know, and that's kind of the new model as well, so you can stay tuned. And that's it for this episode of Overthrows, and yeah, you guys have a good day. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make any content, Minbo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips. Try Minbo.pro now.